All right, everybody. Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, good afternoon, whichever one of those, whenever, however you're listening. Hopefully you're doing well. Today is going to be much more of a lighthearted show than last week's. We talked about campaign financing. It was a pretty intense and fact heavy, data heavy kind of show, which I like doing, but I also like doing this stuff a lot. I talked about it in a podcast probably like 20 episodes ago. I think it was like a Sunday coffee where I talked about my new found love for the Alien and Predator series. And now my guest today shares that common love. So I know we're going to talk about that a little bit today. And it's been a while since I've had him or his brother on. I think the last time I had them on was probably almost like 300 episodes or 200 episodes ago, like 220 episodes ago, which is just way too long because the brothers that I've had on here together, just absolutely fantastic people, and you guys should definitely go support everything that they do. So before we get into today's show, please hit all the links below where you can find myself, my guest, everything he's got going on, everything I've got going on. Go to Tiger Fitness through the links below. Use the code Kyle at checkout. I see someone's been using it quite a bit, and I really appreciate that because not only does that support me, but it also supports the brand that supports you. So all the supplements that get you all jacked and tan and that stuff, they just got the David protein bars, which are very, very low calorie, but very, very high protein. They're like 150 calories for almost 30 grams of protein, which is really good for a protein bar. I had two of them. I bought them from Vitamin Shoppe, and I highly recommend checking all that stuff out. Falcon Sons Coffee, Kyle at checkout, and sorry, Deem Fit through the link below. So with all my shilling out of the way, let's talk about classic horror and classic conspiracy stuff. It's gonna be a lot of fun.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
All right, everybody, and bringing back to the show my fellow horror and fellow music fan, my dear friend Mike Jackman. How you doing, man?
Hey, I'm doing well. How are you, Kyle?
Excellent, and I'm very, very glad we're finally doing this show. I feel like it's been a long time since we kind of got together, but now I'm glad you're back on the show, man. And we got all sorts of cool, a little bit more lighthearted topics to talk about today, which is always a refresher.
Yeah, definitely, man. I'm happy to be back. I mean, it's amazing how a year, 2 years even goes by, and even chat DM with you on, I think we communicate on Facebook primarily. So even just checking the DMs, it's like, wow, I don't think I talked to Kyle for, it's been months now. And usually we chat about horror films or the latest information on Kennedy assassination or whatever. But I'm always happy to talk about horror films, man. As much as I grew up loving politics, I also kind of grew up loving film by and large, but specifically, I really kind of got into horror films at a young age and have never really been able to see me shake it.
Yeah, well, I know you and I have talked about like guar before, and I know that's kind of like in that world as well, but there's like this aesthetic to it, and I didn't quite get it. Like, I was always kind of the outside looking in. Like, I always see this huge cult following for like Comic-Con and all these different comics, Alien, Predator, which we're primarily probably going to talk about today, Terminator, you name it. And like I said, guar is kind of in there because they're more of like the, I don't know what you would call them, but more like they're like a rock band, but they have that same aesthetic. And I once I started getting into Alien and Predator, I'm like, okay, I get the cult following, and I get why, like, some people don't like these films so much, but like they still love everything about the series as a whole. So what kind of got you started down the road of like, oh, like this shock rock horror stuff is my kind of deal?
Well, yeah, I would say it's interesting too. You mentioned guar. I watched the documentary about them not that long ago. That was fantastic. And that really started as like a film concept, the whole guar thing. It's like a project that Dave Brocky and one of the other earlier founding members were doing. And I have a quick GWAR story after out, but I got into horror films probably almost on accident. I was really young. I had to have been maybe between 6 and 8 years old, and I was at home, and I went to bed and I snuck upstairs, and my dad was watching a movie that was on TV at the time, and that movie happened to be Hellbound Hellraiser 2. Oh. And it was one of those things where he kind of knew I snuck up and was watching, but he also like kind of pretended to not see me there, and he basically let me watch the film. And I then had nightmares for a couple weeks afterwards about skinless people coming through my mattress to attack me. Yeah. And I was horrified, but weirdly like interested in it, and like, wow, this is unique. And I don't know, this feeling of being scared, but you know, ultimately that you're safe. So I saw that film, and then I saw Total Recall, of course, the gal at the bar with the three, you know, the three breastises. I don't know if I can say that on YouTube.
Yeah.
And just how violent that was, and Arnold on Mars. So those were like two films that I saw at a very young age. And then like, obviously the original Predator, and it just kind of, got me on that track in the 90s of really looking for and enjoying films like that. And specifically, I really remember going to the movie rental place and seeing the movie covers in the horror section always jumped out to me. I was like, wow, look at that cover. Just the cover alone is scary, and it really interests me, and I wonder what that movie's all about. And that's really how I picked out a lot of movies, based on the cover. And depending on what kind of mood my parents were in, they would rent it for me, or if my mom was away for the weekend and, you know, I was a little bit older, I could convince my dad or an uncle to rent it for me or something like that. Mm-hmm. So, or doing a sleepover at a friend's house, saying, oh, you know, to their parents, oh yeah, no, my mom lets me watch this stuff. This is fine. Yeah, we can, we can rent this. Yeah. And kind of going from there.
Yeah. Like I said, I didn't really watch a lot of films or anything like that growing up, but it's so funny. I think we probably all have stories like that. Oh yeah, you know, they let me play Halo, they let me play whatever. You know, you're watching Mortal Kombat, somebody's like head getting ripped out with their spinal cord, and you're just like, yeah, no, my parents are all right with that. And meanwhile, you know, I could imagine my dad, you know, throwing the Xbox at the wall and leaving a big old chunk missing if he saw, or you know, if he knew that we weren't doing our homework and, you know, slacking off to go play Xbox or something like that. But
oh yeah.
It's funny you mentioned like the covers, and I'm pretty sure I have, I do, the original Predator DVD downstairs, and just everything about the artwork of, you know, Alien and Predator, I found to be so fascinating. And specifically Alien, you really didn't bring up Alien there, but like, when I think back to the original Alien film, it is just astonishing to think that movie came out in 1979. And then what, Predator was 1986, right?
87.
Okay, 86 or 80. Yeah, okay, 87.
Yeah, the first Predator, yeah.
Okay, so like one fascinating thing about horror films back then, and I know you could definitely elaborate on this more than I could, is that you kind of had to use the power of imagination a lot more than anything else. Like nowadays, you can kind of lean on CGI, but like back then, because you didn't have CGI, like the moments where you finally revealed the alien, it had to be, you know, real brief, and it had to really scare the shit out of you, because let's face it, back then it was probably a little bit jank. Although, like, you know, when I watched the original Alien, you know, like almost a year ago now, I was like, holy shit, you know, like it looks really good. The Xenomorph looks awesome. And then same deal with the Predator, I'm like, man, that looks so fucking good. But that's, you know, now almost 50 years ago for some of those. So
just, I like, know.
The fact that they kind of left it to your imagination, there, that seems to be missing in today's world. So I like I said, I know you could probably elaborate on this more with different films as well.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree, Kyle. Like I was even saying this to Eric. We were watching, The Dark Knight trilogy, and those movies came out all in the last 20 years, 05, 08, and 12. And the practical effects that Nolan used in the stunt work, those films look better now than movies that are coming out nowadays that you see. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the original Alien. I mean, the set of the ship and the kind of what they were, I think the fellow's name was H.R. Geiger, who designed the set. Mm-hmm. And it was a tall, you know, athletic dude in a suit as the Xenomorph. And it's very effective, the makeup that they used and the prosthetics. And also, it creates a whole atmosphere too. It does make it more believable. And I think a lot of those early movies don't show as much gore as you see today. But like you said, they like leave it to the imagination. And that almost kind of makes it more scary in some respects. But I really feel like in the 80s is when the rubber and latex and practical effects and prosthetics and masks. And that was like the friggin' zenith, man, for horror, for that stuff. And like a film like Hellraiser, it was the original was only made on like $1 million budget, maybe even less. Shot largely on a soundstage and in a practical house in England. But those effects of the Cenobites, the monsters in that film, I think still hold up to today too. And I think a lot of horror fans really appreciate the craft that goes into, you know, what the makeup department does and the special effects and all the building and construction for to bring a monster alive or a special makeup gag or something like that. And I think that's why the horror genre is such a real special niche for fans, you know, and that's why there's all these conventions. And one that I used to go to a lot was called Rock and Shock in Worcester, Massachusetts. Mm. And I went to a table where there's a show called Holliston. And in the show, they have Odorous Urungus as a character. And I think I had seen a couple episodes. And I wasn't as familiar with gore then as I am now, but I went up to the autograph table to meet the cast, and nobody was there dressed up in the gore stuff. But I was talking to a guy wearing a sports jersey, and we were just – I didn't really know who he was. And I just said, oh, I'm a musician from New Hampshire. He's like, oh, my band's played in New Hampshire before. And I said, oh, what's the name of your band? And he said, oh, it's Gore. And it was Dave Brockie. It was actually Odorous outside of the makeup, and I hadn't seen him – outside of the makeup at that point. So that was cool. And I did get a photo with him. So that was a cool memory. And sadly he passed away, I think a few years after that. But just overall the horror community brings a lot of people under one umbrella. And I feel like maybe with some of the bands that you're in with or the music, there's a great mixture of like heavy metal and different genres of metal that are associated with horror that have really sprung up in recent years, bands like Ice Nine Kills and stuff like that.
Yeah, you know what's funny is I went and saw Trivium and Bolt for my Valentine last night with my brother's girlfriend. Unfortunately, the weather was a little effy, so they had to cancel two of the openers, which I really wanted to see the one opener, Bleed From Within. I was totally bummed out, but like we were on our way back home, and I think we were just talking about like different concerts we went to. And one of the tours that I had went and saw was the Metallica World Tour. And Friday night, it was Mammoth, Van Halen, Pantera, the Metallica. And then Sunday night was Ice Nine Kills, Five Finger Death Punch, and then Metallica. And yeah, I totally loved the it's almost reminiscent of Gwar, like their whole stage performance. They bring out like people and then, you know, we'll slam and break plates and stuff on stage and then hit somebody with a bat. And then, you know, it's a little bit different than Gwar, but like, man, I could rant and rave about Gwar for hours. It was the first concert I ever went to when I was 15 years old. And just that feeling of walking around the gate and then feeling the bass in your chest. And it was Job for a Cowboy that was up first. And then Gwar was second. And I just remember as soon as Gwar went up, everybody got shoved forward. You get blood sprayed all over you. Fake blood, that is.
I was going to say, yeah, did you get sprayed? Did you have to?
I got a white t-shirt somewhere that says Gwar on it that's still stained.
Yeah, from Odorous's intergalactic appendage of sorts. Yeah. Some kind
There's
of weird
video. You could find it on YouTube. If you look up Gwar 2009 Pittsburgh. Them playing Immortal Corruptor, and that was the show I was at. The video quality is so bad because, I mean, it's, you know, 16 years ago now at this point, and Odorous is screaming, oh, give me that. I don't know what I have to do, but I know I have to stab that baby in the pussy fuckhole. And then it's like this baby with a baby grown off its head, and he stabs a sword right in. Oh, it's just hilarious.
It's twisted, but you know, I'll tell you, those guys were really creative and really inventive. That they had when they started, they were like almost like an art kind of film collective, and they had a place. I forget what state they're based out of, but they had like
it's West Virginia, I think, or West Virginia or Virginia.
You know, it might have been Virginia, but they basically had like their own like shop where they built everything.
Richmond, Virginia is where their bar was. Okay, like them and Lamb of God were real tight back in the day.
That was their headquarters. They're based out of there. Yeah. And you know, they were going to make a film originally with the idea, and then that idea became like the band and the collective. And it was cool in the documentary to see that they've actually made a number of films that like narrative films that are really out there. I don't know if you've seen any of them, but they put a lot of time and work and effort into it. And it just, you know, obviously anybody who would see them not really understand what they're all about or their backstory might be a little like, you know, are these guys for real? Are they serious? Like, and there's really just a ton of work and creativity and that goes into it. And I think one of the members left and then came back, you know, they had it like any band, they had like arguments and splits and stuff like that and falling out. But it's a really cool story. And I forget the exact name of the documentary, but it just came out in the last few years. So if anyone is interested in even horror or the music aspect of it, or just art or anything like that, it's a really cool documentary to watch. And I'm pretty sure they gave Odorous Urungus basically like a Viking funeral, where they put the costume at least on a raft in the water and someone shot it with a flaming arrow. So that's pretty cool too. You know, I think he would have appreciated that.
Yeah. I remember Randy Blythe, the singer from Lamb of God, had spoke at Dave Baraki's funeral. And I remember him saying, he said, right now, if it was me in that casket, Dave Baraki would be cracking jokes, but I don't have the stomach for that.
Yeah.
And that's just, you know, by all accounts that I've ever heard of him and like all the stories and obviously just the epic that is Gwar, you can't help but think like, yeah, that's probably true. And you know, it definitely takes a special kind of person to make that whole kind of universe. And like you said, from the outside looking in, people be like, what the fuck? But then like, we just scratch beneath the surface. It's like, wow, like this is just this whole universe of really like, people almost miss all the talent because like the look, but like those guys are insanely good musicians coming from a guitar player. Like I've always thought those guys were just absolutely out of this world.
They are. And they got better as time went on too, obviously. Yes. And they were really good to up and coming talent to take over certain characters. You know, there's obviously the fourth iteration of this character. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, and the physicality of doing that night with the costume, I'm impressed by it. I mean, just as a drummer, you know, a bigger guy doing 3-hour shows myself, I know how physically taxing and demanding that is on you, but to put all that gear on and have the kind of play element, you know, with it is a whole other layer to it. So, and another thing that was really cool, man, I don't know if you remember, it might have been a little before your time, but there was a Beavis and Butthead video game that had yeah. was just Gwar music and all about Gwar, you know. So it was those are the kind of crossovers, man, that I miss. You know, I feel like a lot of stuff nowadays has kind of just become really homogenous and corporate and kind of like defanged. But Ice Nine Kills, man, I love what they do. And they released a video that coincided with the Terrifier 3 that came out last year, you know, Art the Clown and everything. And
that's right. Yeah.
They had Terry Kaiser from Weekend at Bernie's in the video, the dude who played the corpse in Weekend at Bernie's. You know, they had him in there. And they actually run a horror con now, and it's going on to its third or fourth year this year. And they got the cast of Scream announced that they're going to be there. So that's a cool thing to see that there's still people out there doing that. And a lot of fans certainly respond to it. I'm going to try and make it. It's actually at the same place where Rock and Shock used to be down in Worcester, Mass at the DCU Centrum. Mm. So,
yeah, that's kind of cool because it's almost like they're kind of more for people, even like I would say a little bit after my generation, because you're 35, right? 35, 36?
38.
38. Okay.
Well, yeah, a little bit older.
Yeah. Could afford me, but.
Oh, that's very nice of you, Kyle.
Yeah, it's like Gwar was almost like a boomer and Gen Z or Gen X, whatever the hell that generation is, of like the people were probably like 40 to like
40 60 in the 60s.
Years old. Yeah. Gwar was definitely more like their thing. And it's kind of cool because like Ice Nine Kills, they're like a completely different band from Gwar, but they have a lot of elements of like the metalcore I would have grown up on, except for with more modern day elements. And it's kind of cool to see them kind of take up the mantle that Gwar, you know, at one point. up. So it's just, you know, because it doesn't seem like we really do things like that anymore. Like, you know,
yeah. Mixing the music with the film and especially in the horror realm, you know, cause there's so many subgenres of horror now, but at the end of the day, man, I think people like to see practical effects. They like to see the blood and you know, the horror community, it's interesting. Like, you know, dudes like you and I, ultimately, we're like anti-war, like kind of freedom-loving type dudes, right? But we watch these violent films. You know what I mean? Like, it's a weird, I've had discussions with my friends and family about that. Like, Mike, why do you like these movies? You know, you're an anti-war dude. You really don't like violence in real life. But like I said, it's escapism. And I think all the great horror films and all the great horror kind of movements that have happened, at least since the 60s, always have something to say about society, about the world at large, and about issues that are really kind of ahead of its time. I mean, you could go back to like George Romero's Night of the Living Dead in 1968. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not into the woke shit, but the lead role of Ben was just, he didn't specify what, if it was going to be a black guy, a white dude, whatever. He just said, I'm looking for the best actor for the role. And they cast, I think his name was Dwayne Jones. He was a African-American, and he freaking killed it, knocked it out of the park. And he happened to be a black guy, and no one made it. They didn't make a big deal out of it. So that's, you know, that's a cool thing to see. And of course, we set off air earlier, the mall where they shot Dawn of the Dead is being threatened by Walmart. And my friend John Brennan, who is a big horror guy, musician, and used to be on The Last Drive-In. I don't know if you ever saw that show on Shudder. The Last Drive-In with Joe Bob Briggs. He was their music guy and stuff. He penned a great piece for Fangoria called Save the Monroeville Mall. Excuse me, because it looks like Walmart has purchased the land, or they're looking to purchase it, and they might knock it down. And this place, you said it's not far from where you live in Pennsylvania, Kyle?
Yeah, I used to work not even 5 minutes up the road from here. And it's funny, I could see this wall right in front of where they're at, and I know exactly where that's at the mall. Like, it's right by where the Macy's is there, because Macy's on like one corner of the parking lot. I'm pretty sure that's the wall right beside Macy's right there. So yeah, it's fascinating to me. I actually didn't know that, like, Night of the Living Dead was shot there.
Oh, Dawn of the Dead.
Dawn of the Dead. I'm sorry. Yeah,
the sequel. Yeah, that was shot there, and that's regarded, and I tend to agree, as the greatest zombie film of all time. If anybody out there hasn't seen it, it was remade and came out in 2004 by Zack Snyder, which was okay. It was you know, it wasn't terrible, but the zombies ran, which was kind of a point of contention.
Yeah,
I don't know where you are on that, but I need zombies to not be running.
Yeah, the running zombies doesn't really, like, in all zombie games I've ever played, it's usually not like a big sell for me. Like, the greatest zombie game of all time for me is definitely Dead Rising, and none of those zombies run.
Right. Or House of the Dead. Did you ever play that one?
What is it?
House of the Dead, I think it's called. I don't know if that's a zombie game. I think it was a zombie game. I'll be honest, man. I kind of fell off on the gaming after Nintendo 64. GoldenEye, like Mario Kart. Yeah. I go to my buddy's, dude. He has a Super Nintendo system, and I'll go down there for the weekend, and my friggin' something in my brain will come back, dude, and I'll just start playing that thing like I'm a friggin' 10-year-old again, dude. Just crushing Ninja Turtles in Time with my brother, beating the game in like 20 minutes.
Yeah, it's crazy to me looking at this, because I know this so well.
You've been there. You actually been in there, and
more times than I can even imagine count. My wife and I were just out that way this past weekend. Yeah, I used to go there all the time. There's a Red Robin there. There's a steakhouse there. Hibachi place. Nice. Guitar Center's in the back parking lot. Yeah, I've spent a lot of time there. In fact, one of my favorite Chinese places is actually in that mall. So.
I haven't made the pilgrimage. I'd like to. Hopefully they don't bulldoze it. You know, the two Pennsylvania pilgrimages I need to make. I need to make it out there, and I need to make it to Shanksville, to where Flight 93 crashed. I've actually never been there.
The Monroeville Mall is about 25 minutes from me, and then Shanksville is about an hour from me. And I haven't gone to Shanksville yet. I really like to, but I know from you guys that's probably like 13 hours to get here.
Yeah, from New Hampshire, you know, I mean, I've driven through Pennsylvania a couple times, man. It's bigger than people think.
It's a long state. You know?
It's beautiful, though, man. I love my time in Pennsylvania. In fact, I may have mentioned this to you last time. We shot a two-video kind of short film concept for Cannibal Corpse in Pennsylvania back in 2020.
Yeah, that's
Mm-hmm. And they didn't use what we shot, but we shot a full length 2-part, 10-minute music video for two of their songs off their new album. And I guess the word came down is Corpse Grinder watched it and he just didn't think it fit for what they were going for. It wasn't, but they reshot it. They used some of the same concept. I was really bummed, but long story short, that was a really cool experience to be basically hired by them, paid to shoot, because they needed twins. So they had Eric and I and another set of twins. And we shot on set at Field of Screams in Pennsylvania and a private farm. I forget what town it was in Pennsylvania. But it was beautiful, man. I mean, just really beautiful country and friendly people we had never met before who let us set up shop on their farm and in their barn and do all these bloody effects and everything. And sadly, the guy that directed that, Doug Stackman, who was a horror makeup legend, passed away. He's from Philadelphia last June. So he was a really talented dude. And he gave my brother and I, he cast us in that. So that was a really cool experience. But the footage is out there somewhere. I don't know if it will ever get repurposed with for another band. But Doug had done a couple videos for Cannibal Corpse. So that was an interesting experience.
That's awesome.
It was a lot of fun. Yeah, it was pretty cool, man. Being covered in fake blood in the middle of just before the 2020 election, during the height of the flu world order. And we were like in our own bubble. So that's the horror genre, though, man. I mean, it brings people together. Ultimately, I really feel like it does.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. So they recently released, and I love that they're doing this, the new Predator Badlands and the Predator, Killer of Killers. And then I think there was like a little Easter egg of Alien in one of those. And then also Alien Earth is coming out.
Yeah.
So what were your thoughts on the Predator Badlands preview?
So Badlands is the one where we go from the POV of a young predator, right? That's the...
I think so.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting concept, because I kind of feel like they've taken the Predator, at least in the last two installments. So you had Predators with Adrian Brody from 2010, which is a really great sequel, in my opinion. Lawrence Fishburne's in that one, Walton Goggins, Danny Trejo, the fellow from Spider-Man 3, and that Topher Grace. And that was cool because towards, you know, not spoiler alert, everybody, on a 15-year-old movie, towards the end of that film, there's a smaller predator who's captured by a larger predator prime, and Adrian Brody teams up with him to take on the larger, more powerful predator. And I thought that was really friggin' cool. Yeah. And they're kind of I think they're going with that motif for this new one. The main character beside the young predator, I think, is a droid, who is from the Weyland Corporation from the Alien timeline, from the Alien films. If you notice in the trailer, she has a patch that says that corporation. So I picked up on that. And she's going to be the main character along with this young predator. And they have to fight bigger creatures on this hunting planet. So I'm intrigued, man. I'm intrigued for that one. I'm looking forward to it. And I'm really excited for the other one you mentioned, Killer of Killers, the kind of the animated where it's like I think it's a World War One or World War Two era soldiers go up against a predator and their technology, and that looks really interesting.
Okay. So
I don't know if that's going to be more of an anthology type thing or if it's just going to be an animated narrative in that era, because I know the fellow who did Prey, the follow-up to Prey, he had hinted that we're going to see something from World War One or World War Two. And I really enjoyed Prey. What did you think about that one?
Loved that movie. I liked the ones like the Predators that came before it. Predators, and then there was one before that.
Oh, the Predator.
The Predator. Okay, yeah. Those were okay. I
had the autistic kid break the code. It's like, yeah, score for the libertarians. The autistic kid's stopping the war.
They're gonna win more. We gotta win one every once in a while, you know. We'll probably never see any other victory, but
well, I released Albrecht. I did that, okay. But yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to.
Yeah, that's okay. Prey. I loved that film, and like my only beef with it would be kind of like the whole girl power thing, where you have like this young tribal girl who kills the predator. But like, I tell people this all the time, like. the feral predator, which is what like the predator in that movie was, one of my favorite like science fiction creatures I've ever seen. Yeah, the face just looked awesome. The way it stood there with the mask and everything, just everything about the aesthetic of that movie and of the predator, I just thought was fucking awesome. And I remember watching, like, I go on these weird sprees, and I know there's probably people in the comments that have done this too. You look up all the fatalities in Mortal Kombat, you look up all the death scenes in a certain movie, and I did that for all the Alien and Predator movies. And I remember watching the Prey once, like, oh, that's fucking brutal. And then finally watching the movie, I'm like, this movie actually kicks ass. Like, the CGI wasn't like over the top. It wasn't like over the top gore for gore's sake or anything right. like that. It was just like a good movie with a good story, and like the setting was pretty neat. And then, you know, towards the end, that's when like the pilgrims kind of come in, and then, you know, he deals with all of them. And then it kind of reminds you of like the classic Predator film. And I'm glad that Alien Romulus did something very similar to this, where it was kind of like, you know, in the original Predator, when Arnold Schwarzenegger gets all painted up and mudded up to go kill the Predator. It was the same kind of deal at the end of Prey, you know. And like I was talking about Alien, the original Alien, you know, the movie's about done. And then, Sigourney, or whatever the hell her name is,
Ripley,
that's it. I don't know why I can never remember her name, but yeah, Ellen Ripley's on the ship and everything's okay, and then, you know, the alien comes out of the wall and she has to put out the airlock. In Romulus, same kind of deal, where she has to deal with the spawn. I can't remember exactly what it's called, but same deal at the end of Romulus, like that kind of deal where like the whole movie kind of seems like it's over and there's one last little fight.
Yeah,
like I always love that about that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they had that totally. For Prey, and hopefully they kind of do something for it. It was like a return, kind of like a thumbs up to the originals. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, and I love the callback with the pistol. That's the same pistol that he throws to Danny Glover's character at the end of the second one. He's like, take it. That's the gun that he got from the, what you were mentioning, the colonizers there. Mm-hmm. And I would say my favorite Predator sequel probably is Predator 2, man. That I grew up with that one, dude. You can feel the heat coming off the screen in that film. I mean, that is putting that in a near futuristic, I think, LA, and with Danny Glover and Ruben Blades and Bill Paxton. I mean, the cast was fantastic, and they got the same guy to come back from the first Predator, Kevin Michael Hall, I think his name is. He's like 7 feet tall. Sadly, he died from of AIDS, from a blood transfusion that he got, that Ooh. Guy. And you can actually see him out of the Predator makeup in the first movie in the helicopter at the end when Arnold is rescued. Mm. And then, of course, you got Gary Busey, dude, in Predator 2. I mean, he's, you know, a couple years off his head injury, dude. Yeah, yeah.
Sean, literally right before you said it.
Sean, you know what I'm talking about. Yeah, it turns out they don't like the cold. They can't see the heat signature. Dude, they got him in that outfit, man, where he's like spraying the Predator with the. I mean, dude, it's like quintessential early 90s action, too, man. And that was really cool. That just shows you, too, like the, you know, their race, they're just all in for the hunt. And they see Danny Glover kill one. They're like, hey, good on you, man. We're you got one of us, man. That's what it's all about. We'll be back. But I always thought that was cool. Yeah. And they use some of the elements I mentioned earlier in Alien versus the first Alien versus Predator of a human teaming up with a Predator. And that was it was a little bit more cheesy and corny. I don't know if you remember that one.
Yeah, I watched both those. I'm glad you're going next. I want to ask about those. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I enjoyed them for what they are. Mm-hmm. I thought Alien versus Predator Requiem was pretty bad, in my opinion. Like, it's just not a well-lit movie. It's, you know, I don't know. The characters aren't as compelling. It's hard to see what's going on half the time. But it was a cool concept to see realized, the original Alien versus Predator, and seeing Lance Henriksen being killed as a human as opposed to being killed as an android, you know, in the second one. He's a great character in the second one. I forget his name. Someone in the comments will. Do you remember his name? The second one is the droid. It was, I forget, but. So I think Lance Henriksen and Bill Paxton are the only two actors to be killed by a Terminator, a Predator, and a Xenomorph. I'm pretty sure. Bishop. His name is Bishop. Thank you, Sean.
Nice. Yeah. I it was just kind of cool. Like, I don't want to say fanfare, but, you know, like you said, the movies were kind of cheesy, but it's like, you know, it's kind of a cool concept because it's like fun. the two like unique sci-fi horror films that were like so I don't want to say ubiquitous, but like so well known to kind of put those in a world together. I'm just like, ah, you know, this is cool. Just enjoy it for what it is. I played through the Alien Isolation, and just the way that they kind of designed that game, they had made it all based on basically your Ripley's daughter, and you go on the Weyland-Yutani ship, and then you go all through it, and the predator, the alien has like a really, really good AI, and just like the whole aesthetic of it, and then like the way that you also kind of customize different weapons to kind of fight off stuff on the ship was just really, really neat. And then, you know, at the end of the game, it's very, very, it, just a lot of it's a lot like the classic Alien film, except for you're playing as, you know, Ripley's daughter. It's just really, really cool. So I've grown to...
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Really, really love just the whole horror concept with specifically those two movies. It's just like they're such perfect sci-fi. One other thing I wanted to ask you about was what the hell was that movie? Prometheus. Prometheus. What did you think about Prometheus?
I like Prometheus. I thought that was interesting. Guy Pearce was really good in that, and it was a little bit muddled. Kind of wondering what that like black substance was, and how did those like tall white things create the aliens? Is that what they? I was a little bit. I think I might need to go back and rewatch it. But I enjoyed that one, and then there was one that came out after that. Was that Covenant? Alien?
Yeah. There was Alien Covenant, Prometheus, then Covenant, and then Romulus. Came out in 2024.
Yeah, I liked Romulus, and I guess there is a sequel coming out to that one as well.
Yeah,
that they're gonna do. So, I think Ridley Scott is at least involved as far as producing, right? I don't know if he directed the last couple. I always thought Alien 3 kind of got an unfair rap. That was I don't know if you ever saw that one.
Yeah, that's the one where they're in the prison.
Yeah, Ripley shaves her head.
Yeah, it was a little goofy, and like the CGI for the alien was bad, but the movie was still good overall.
It was still pretty cool. They had Ralph Brown, who played Del Preston in the Wayne's World movies, was in that, and I got to meet him some years back and chat with him, so that was cool. But that was a little, I don't know, I thought the fourth one, Resurrection, was pretty cheesy, where they clone Ripley or they get her DNA, and they the CGI in that one is so bad.
Yeah. Yeah, I watched both of those. I'm like, yeah, like part of the Alien series, but like you said, the CGI in 3 and 4, I was like, all right, this is a little goofy. So
pure 90s.
Yeah. Prometheus, when I watched that one, I'm like, wow, that's actually like a really good movie. And then when I went back and I started to just research all the old lore, then I finally kind of understood, like, basically just that whole ending was basically about, okay, well, this is like the start. And then, you know, you have David, the droid, and basically he wanted to manipulate the alien, you know, through, Dr. Shaw, I think it was.
Oh yeah. And basically that was just Fassbender, right? Michael Fassbender.
No, that was the woman.
Noomi Rapace, or
that's it. Yeah. Something like that.
But Fassbender played the droid Michael, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Or the synthetic, whatever you want to call him.
Yeah. And then he, basically just would manipulate the way that the alien had replicated itself over time. And then eventually, you know, like they had the protomorph in, Covenant, and then eventually it became the protomorph, and then it wasn't like a xenomorph, it had a little bit different characteristics in Covenant, and then you finally get like the xenomorph obviously after that, which would have been the start of, you know, the original Alien. Sean, yeah, Alien 3 has a crazy backstory about how it was made. you get why it was weird if you see what all happened. Okay, yeah. And I, the one thing that like kind of stood out, it was a big deal in Aliens that Ripley saved the little girl. You know, at the very end, she's killing the giant alien queen, and then she wakes up and the girl's dead. And it's kind of like, okay, well, there's kind of like a lot missing
here. Yeah, yeah. Newt, that was Newt. And then obviously Hicks, Michael Biehn's character, who I was hoping was going to be in a version that was supposed to be made about a decade ago, where they ignore three or they kind of retcon it, where Newt and Hicks survive the deep freeze after Aliens. But I guess Sigourney has said that's not going to be made, and she's like 70. She's in like her mid to late 70s. I think she said she's done with Ripley. So maybe thankfully that's one they're not going to go back and do that kind of CGI deep fake stuff to make them look younger. So that might be a good thing. I mean, there's so many things they can do. Look what they're doing with Predator. And it's incredible to see both these films are still going. And I think they really inspired a lot of cool horror sci-fi films like Event Horizon and Pandorum are two really great space horror flicks if you've never seen those as well.
I'll have to check those out. Send those in the private message so that way I'll write them down and I'll remember to get them out of there. So the other thing I wanted to talk to you about today was JFK, and I listened to a few of your podcasts on specifically JFK, and like every single time I start to learn about JFK, I'm like, holy shit, there is just such an iceberg here. Like, it's, you know, crazy. The story we hear, convertible car ride through Dallas, Lee Harvey Oswald shoots JFK with a magic bullet, and somehow, you know, the way that he bounces back, we're supposed to believe that it went down and up and then what, through his head, and that was it. And I just heard Douglas Murray talking about this, where he said that, like, oh, you know, that there were 9 different professionally trained shooters that allegedly could have made this bullet. And then I was listening to the 2 year shows that you did with Corey Hughes, and you guys seemed to come to the conclusion that Lee Harvey Oswald wasn't involved in the shooting at all. So I know that's kind of a lot, but like, I guess one other thing is just that, like, I see a lot of people saying, oh, Israel killed JFK. I'm like, I'm sure they had a hand in it, but to say that just Israel killed JFK seems incomplete. The same way that, like, if people said Israel did 9/11 seems incomplete. Right. So what's kind of your take on JFK from like a 50,000 foot view? And maybe we kind of talk about some of the oddities, some of the stuff that you find most interesting.
Yeah. And yes, so my own personal opinion is that Lee Harvey Oswald did not fire a gun that day. Didn't shoot JFK, and also did not shoot Officer Tippit about 25, 30 minutes later after the assassination. Because that's what he was originally picked up for at the Texas Theater, was shooting Tippit. Okay. But I think a real big part of this can, if you want to go into the physical stuff and Dealey Plaza, you can just hinge on the rifle. I mean, initially, 3 Dallas police officers, Seymour Weitzman, Roger Craig, and Eugene Boone, on the 6th floor, retrieved a rifle, and that they said, here it is. There it is right there in the sniper's nest. And the rifle that they retrieved was actually a 7.65 German Mauser. And it had stamped right on the rifle, 7.65 Mauser. And that's how Walter Cronkite and the media reported it for the next 3 days. So to me, how does that Mauser rifle then become an Italian Mannlicher rifle? That's right, because the whole case hinges on it was one shooter, and it was an Italian Mannlicher Carcano bolt action. I think it's a World War II era rifle, which I think the nickname for it was the Peacemaker, because it's hard to shoot anything with it. You know, it was just such a piece of crap. I'm sure for your listeners who are more inclined in firearms can. And not only that, but Seymour Weitzman from the Dallas Police Department used to own a sporting goods store, and he sold guns and rifles. So for him to confuse a German Mauser with an Italian Mannlicher Carcano when they're looking at the thing 8 inches from their face, that to me, just like that alone right there, man, it's never really been explained. But yeah, Corey Hughes, he's done some amazing research. And if you haven't had him on your show, you should definitely get him on. I'm sure I could connect you guys if you're interested.
Gladly.
He's been doing this every day full time for the last 8 years. I've certainly been researching it and studying it for most of my life, but I've, you know, I also, you know, kind of went into 9/11 for many years of my life and the RFK assassination. And there's only so many things you can, you know, but I've come back that I have to say the last couple of years, I have come back to the Kennedy assassination, the John F. Kennedy assassination. And I'm encouraged to see more people talking about it and that want to see files come out. And I think it's great that the files are coming out. I think a lot of the story already did come out, though, in Jim Garrison's investigation in the 60s, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, which was tasked with investigating MLK and JFK in the 70s. A lot came out with that. But certainly a lot of stuff was destroyed, never entered in evidence, or just covered up. So, I mean, there's many different ways you can go with the assassination. But I think just starting there with the rifle, you know, and then going out, and they brought in that night the top ballistics firearm expert who got fingerprints off of rifles and guns for murders and crimes at the time in the country. And they brought that thing into a secure room, and they lit it, and he did everything he could to get fingerprints off it. He could not get any of Lee Harvey Oswald's fingerprints off the rifle that day. Until after Oswald died is when they got a smudged like palm print. And there's a story of a funeral home employee where Oswald's remains were being dealt with before burial, who said that, you know, two men came in who were obviously with some government agency in suits, and said, we need to see Oswald's body. And he's like, okay. So they came in and he let them look at Oswald's body. And when he came back to look at Oswald, he had ink on his hand. So what do you think? What were they doing in there? You know what I mean? Oh, I don't remember that guy's specific name, but you can see his interview in a film series called The Men Who Killed Kennedy, which was the first documentary series that really got me into the assassination when I was like a 10-year-old boy. I watched that. It was produced by the BBC in the late 80s and early 90s, and it just blew me away. I since think that there's some stuff in there that didn't pan out and isn't necessarily as solid as other evidence, but certainly, man, they talked to a lot of witnesses, and a lot of witnesses said, not only was this testimony changed that I gave to the Warren Commission or I gave to the FBI or Dallas Police, there's stuff in here that I didn't even say. So, okay, just that. Why are you going to witness tamper if it's just Oswald, three shots, one rifle from behind, right?
Yeah, so one thing I kind of want to go back to there that I never heard and that I think is quite profound is they couldn't find Lee Harvey Oswald's prints on a gun. So who the hell's prints did they find, and was that ever published?
That's a good question. The official story does say, oh, yes, no, we did. We did find his prints on the gun, but it's like the chain of custody and the evidence would not hold up in a trial. So that's one of the reasons why they had to kill him, of course. And the gun that they have in the National Archives might not even be that same gun because there's issues with the scope. There's issues with how long it is. Like there's tons of issues. And not to mention the bullet fragments. Like you mentioned the magic bullet earlier, you know, Commission Exhibit 399, I think it's called. And if you look at that bullet, it's like really intact. I mean, there's a little bit of wilting and a little bit of denting on it, but there was more remnants of a bullet found in one part of John Connolly during his surgery than was missing from that bullet that allegedly caused all seven of those wounds hitting Kennedy, then entering Connolly. So that doesn't add up. I'm not like a forensic expert by any means, but
basically what you're kind of getting at here, I want to make sure I get this clear, is that like the damage on the bullet that's stored in, you said Exhibit 399 or whatever it is, that bullet has some damage to it, but it doesn't explain the full amount of damage in the remainders of a bullet that was in the other individual.
And Connolly. Yeah.
Connolly. Okay. Yeah.
Just Connolly. I mean, just him. And I think he was hit multiple times. I mean, if you can look at the Zapruder film and try and see the timing on that and everything. And obviously people have done that. So yeah, I mean, the physical stuff, what actually happened during the shooting is obviously very fascinating, and what people saw. You know, there were prisoners in the county jail, which was adjacent to the book depository, who saw multiple men on the sixth floor, during the time of the shooting. And they were all hollering and screaming, trying to raise awareness for that. And they saw multiple men. There's really only one witness who says, oh yeah, I saw Lee Harvey Oswald in the corner of the sixth floor with a rifle. And people have gone and stood where he stood, and there's no way you could make out a person's face like that. Mm-hmm. And he changed his testimony a couple times too. So, yeah, I mean, it hinges on him being in that window at the time of the shots, and I just don't think there's really any solid evidence that puts him there.
Okay, so
from there, you can go in many different directions.
One of the things I remember Corey mentioning was a couple gentlemen being in front of a power panel at, I think it was 1:30 like p.m. or something like that. And in theory, someone who was in the building that Lee Harvey Oswald was in tried to use the elevator, and like some of the timing didn't line up. What am I recalling here?
So that could be, there's a couple different stories there. There's the three witnesses who were on the fourth floor, two floors below where Oswald would have been. And they, after the shooting, they vamoosed right out of there, probably within like 15 or 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. So they should have absolutely, two of them at least should have seen Oswald on the stairs coming down. And they didn't. And then the other woman who was there, who lingered a little bit longer, she didn't see Oswald either. And Roy Truly, the building manager, when the, I think his name was Patrolman Baker, ran into the depository and said, you know, we need to look through this building. And this was like right after the shots happened. They made their way to the lunchroom on the second floor, where according to their testimony, they ran into Lee Harvey Oswald drinking a Coke calmly. So for him to be there drinking that Coke calmly, he would have had to have stashed the rifle, you know, wiped his prints, ran through a maze of boxes. They were doing work on the floor up there too that day. So he wouldn't have been able to quickly get to that point without being winded. But as far as the elevators, Corey's told me that the power in the building was shut off at the time of the shooting at 12:30, which was very interesting. And he thinks that the actual gunman, who he names as these kind of semi mercenary intelligence type dudes who had been traveling the country and specifically had been in the Dallas, Fort Worth, New Orleans area impersonating Oswald and kind of using his name while doing stuff to draw attention to themselves. They were the actual, two of them were the shooters and there was a spotter. So he puts between two and three dudes on the sixth floor, two shooters, one in the actual sniper's nest where Oswald was supposed to have been, and then one all the way down on the other end at a more steeper angle, which might explain some of Connolly's wounds. And so he's got a great book called A Warning from History.
Yeah. And
if your audience wants to check that out, it came out in late 2023. He's got a new book coming out, and he has hours and hours of research and he's got like a 7-hour presentation on the whole thing. He goes through the whole thing, and I think I don't agree with him on everything, but I think he makes a really compelling case. And for further deep research, you know, check his stuff out. Mm-hmm. Check out, you know, any of the work Jim DiEugenio did. He wrote the script for Oliver Stone's movie Reclaiming History and JFK. I think it was called JFK Revisited. He had two documentaries come out in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And he's a great OG. I mean, there's a lot of great researchers, but, you know, debunkers like to focus on the mainstream talking points. And anybody who looks at this with any honesty sees the thing fall apart immediately because it's just ridiculous. It doesn't even make any sense. Like, why would a dude who was supposedly like a leftist communist who never had anything bad to say about Kennedy shoot him? There was never any motive or any reason. And they call him a loner, which was not true. He actually had friends, and he was an intelligent guy with a high IQ. And there's a whole narrative about Oswald that the media has talked about for 60 years, and it really doesn't hold up to any deep scrutiny when you actually look at it.
Okay, yeah, then I guess the two things I want to follow up on here is, I guess let's go with the less controversial one, and that's kind of, I heard Peter Thiel originally say this, and he said, oh, well, there's a lot of speculation around Cuba. Now, I think the Cuban explanation, and please patch us together if I do a poor job stating this, is that Kennedy had threatened to blow up the world if Russia were to put nukes in Cuba. So therefore, Cuba wanted to maintain its sovereignty. So therefore, they, you know, committed to a conspiracy to assassinate the president, JFK. Does that sound about right for like what that narrative would be?
Right.
And where do you think this falls apart?
Yeah, I think certainly the plotters wanted to have that idea out there that this if sure. it was a conspiracy, it was a Cuban plot. That's mm-hmm. that's what they wanted to have out there. And there is a transcript of President Johnson, who took over right after Kennedy was killed, talking to J. Edgar Hoover basically the next day, saying, we got to get this thing buttoned up. We need to convince people that it was only one gunman, because we don't want to start World War III. And that's what we're looking at. We're mm-hmm. looking at nuclear annihilation. It's funny because I don't think Johnson wanted to really do did want to do that war, but they could use that as an excuse for the cover up. Well, we had to do the cover up because if we didn't, we were looking at a huge nuclear war. So that's the Cuban angle, I think, in a lot of ways. But there was a large group of Cubans that were pissed off with JFK after the Cuban Missile Crisis. Well, the Bay of Pigs early on in his presidency, mm-hmm. who felt like they got left with their dicks to the wind. So there could have been, anti-Castro Cubans who were kind of mercenaries who had semi-relationships with the mob and the U.S. government, who certainly could have been involved. I think that's a possibility. I think the main players, certainly for the cover-up, had to have been the U.S. military, like the Pentagon and our intelligence agencies. And to your mentioning of Israel earlier, there's aligned interests. I mean, certainly the leader of Israel at the time, who had to resign, Ben Gurion, who it's called the war of letters back and forth between him and Kennedy, talking about their nuclear facilities. You know, Kennedy said, under no uncertain terms are you guys going to get the bomb. I don't want you guys having the bomb. And you have to register as a foreign lobbyist.
So I'm glad you're going here. Yeah, the battle letters, Sean. Sean's sticking right along with us here.
Sean knows his stuff.
Yeah, I wanted to go into the Israel angle as well, because like I said, I think a lot of people somewhat irresponsibly say, oh, Israel killed JFK. And I think if you take a, far enough out view and look at it, and like the facts you just mentioned, hey, JFK didn't want them to have nuclear weapons, which they're still the only country in the world that doesn't have to register their nuclear weapons. And the U.S. still doesn't recognize a nuclear program.
It's a wink, wink. Oh, yeah, we don't have them, but.
Exactly. Right.
We're not going to strike first, but we will strike back. It's like, okay.
Yeah. Well, and on top of that, the U.S. also won't either say they do or don't. They just are very ambiguous about it. And then, like you just said, JFK wanted them to register under the Foreign Agents Registry Act, which every other country in the world has to register under, except for Israel. So when you look at that, and then you also throw in the Jack Rubenstein angle, which I know everybody calls him Jack Ruby, but his full name is Jack Rubenstein, him being the person that killed Lee Harvey Oswald. I get where people go with this, but when I've heard you and Corey and your brother Eric talk all about this, it seems like you guys are like, oh yeah, they definitely play a part, but it's probably a conspiracy amongst, the FBI, the CIA, and the Mossad, and probably some other angles. So what's your kind of explanation and thoughts on the whole Israel angle?
Well, I mean, to me, like, could Israel have controlled what happened inside the United States during the cover-up, during the autopsy, with respect to, what the intelligence agencies did? And there's some researchers who would say, yes, absolutely. And there's some credibility to that, especially with the recent stuff that's come out with respect to Israel and the high-ranking CIA official, James Jesus Angleton, who was an avowed Zionist and actually got got honored over in Israel after he died. Like, he got official recognition that they don't really do for foreigners. I think they did it for Oscar Schindler. They did it for James Angleton, and they did it for Ghislaine Maxwell's father, Robert Maxwell, ironically. So, like I said before, it's aligning interests. And yes, Jacob Rubenstein, aka Jack Ruby, connected to the mob, but not just the Italian mob, the Jewish mafia, through figures like Meyer Lansky. Damn. And and of course Ryan Dawson and Corey Hughes have done. They are the OGs on this, and they've done the treasure trove of research. And Ryan's film, NUMEC, is an essential watch for your audience. I'm sure you've talked about it. I mean, you've had Ryan on. I'm sure he's mentioned it. So they, there's a quote attributed to someone connected to the assassination that said, after we take care of Kennedy, our new financiers are going to be Israeli or Jewish. I forget the exact quote. So they're there is stuff there. And if you pull on the thread of Jack Ruby, you do get to, like, you know, I don't know if Bugsy Siegel was still around then, but I've heard his name thrown around in the mix. And there's others that are connected directly back to Ben-Gurion. And, you know, Israel was worried about JFK even back when he was a senator, because his father, Joseph Kennedy, was not very big on Jewish people in Israel. And he was pretty vocal about that. So they were worried that JFK wasn't. And they were looking at him very early on in his career. When he was in the Senate in the 50s, they already kind of didn't like him because of he viewed the Palestinians as human beings. And certainly later on, I think Robert favored the right of return and Palestinian rights. So, I mean, that's a whole other thing, obviously. But that, I believe that is, both assassinations are connected. And so they were worried about the Kennedys. And they had the letters. The letters were very heated. And rather than deal with it, you know, Ben-Gurion resigned because he did not respond to the final letter. And then a month or two later, Kennedy's dead. Johnson becomes president and totally reverses course on Israel and holding them accountable for their nukes and for spying on America, for anything. I mean, I think Johnson, before Trump, was probably the most pro-Israel president we've had, Lyndon Johnson. You had the USS Liberty event in 67, obviously this the Six-Day War. So there's a lot of stuff that probably wouldn't happen had Kennedy survived. And people trace a byline all the way to present-day neocons and all those connections, and those certainly align with Zionism. So foreign policy-wise, I think there's definitely a lot there. But the more, like, nitty-gritty and like, with Ruby, like, some researchers think, well, he had cancer. He knew he had cancer, and he was sick, and we're going to have you do this. And, you know, you're going to be hailed as a hero. We'll get you a lot of money. Maybe you'll serve a couple years, but you're doing a good thing here. This notion that Jack Ruby shot Oswald because he was such a Kennedy fan, he felt bad for Jackie, and he wanted to spare her the indignity of a trial, that's a BS thing that his lawyers came up with. That's a total sham and a total lie. And in fact, just after the assassination and after Oswald is killed, Ruby is visited in jail by the CIA MKUltra mind control doctor, Jolly West, a lot earlier than that had been previously acknowledged, which is crazy. And that guy also visited Timothy McVeigh later on after the whole Oklahoma City thing. And I think what he did was he totally he either drugged Ruby with LSD or psyoped him or brainwashed him or drugged him and did something to him and said, yeah, he's not competent. So there was no retrial, and then he dies of fast-moving cancer in 1967, and there you go. There's a lot of threads to – I think Ruby is a linchpin, is a big linchpin in the whole thing. And there's connections to drug running. There's connections to Nixon through Ruby. Ruby was like, oh, yeah, I know who that guy is. He recognized him when he saw him on TV. So it's it's crazy, man. There's books. There's literally books just about all of these different factions within the Kennedy assassination. And a really great early researcher, Penn Jones, told an author I had on, Joseph McBride. He said, pick one area of the assassination and make that your obsession and your goal and your focal point. And I think there's a lot of great researchers out there who have done that. So it's it's a big one. You could do a whole show just on Jack Ruby. And I want to have Corey back on soon to do that. Actually, I'm going to invite him back on, but I think he'd be a great guest for your show too, Kyle.
Yeah, I would have him on in a heartbeat, because the more I hear him talk, it's just like, I feel like I'm listening to a dude who knows as much as I do about, like, automotive technology, except for the assassination. I'm like, this dude just knows his shit. He's like, oh, yeah, at this time, you know, specifically, like, after this so many seconds, this would have happened. You know, the jacket was here at this Texaco station. And you know, these people in front of the electrical panel. I'm like, holy fuck, how do you remember all this shit?
He's unreal. And, you know, the thing is, he was a cop for 10 years. So he uses those skills to look at it through that framework. And it's pretty fascinating. I mean, I know I paid you to do some broad strokes there, but with the Kennedy assassination, there's so many angles. And I think a lot, unfortunately, the media wants people to focus on the wrong thing and keep people fighting. But bigger picture, he was eliminated by a plot, and our country hasn't been the same since.
Yeah. last couple of minutes, I know you got to wrap here soon, but I recall Corey saying something about like a lot of the files already being out there, and what the Trump administration did with some of these files is just like, they said, oh, this is like a new copy, like a cleaner copy than what's already available. And like a whole bunch of the stuff that you would kind of hope would not be redacted is redacted. It just kind of seemed like a, I don't want to say a virtue signal, but just kind of like a pat on the back to get the administration some street cred. Is that accurate, or do you think there's more to it?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, I would say more so with the Epstein files. That was a big boy. That was a bunch of bollocks. All the folders.
Yeah, Chaya Raychick, known Israeli lobbyist, holding on to the Epstein files. You have to be fucking kidding me if you want me to believe this is serious.
And that was all stuff, Kyle, that had already been released. Those flight manifests had already been released. The black book. Yeah. The victims' names were blacked out, which I agree with. I mean, you want to protect the victims. Like, look, you don't want people's social security numbers and phone numbers and victims' names being on there. I totally understand that. But otherwise, that was all stuff that's already out there. Mm-hmm. But with the Kennedy files, Trump did release a lot of stuff in 2017, mm-hmm. which by law, under the JFK Records Act of 92, they said 25 years from now, October of 2017, this all has to come out. Mm-hmm. And he even tweeted, he's like, at long last, all the Kennedy files are going to come out. We're going to see some great stuff. And he got a visit, I believe, from Mike Pompeo, and he was urged by Mike Pence to not release everything. Mm-hmm. So that also kind of shows you, like, CIA is still kind of running a lot of shit. They don't really care who the president is. They're gonna say, oh, look what we're doing over here. And meanwhile, over here, they're doing something else, or they're pocket weaseling something.
Yeah.
So they did that with Trump. But there were releases in 2017. There were releases in 2018. And then he kicked the can down the road a few more years. And then to Brandon's credit, they released some. But then they did a really sneaky thing where they basically said there's going to be no more releases after this. And now it's back to the discretion of the CIA, which under the JFK Records Act is actually illegal what they did. But they don't give a shit. They don't give who's going to enforce it. So to Trump's credit, he came in there and signed that thing the first week, releasing everything unredacted. And I have to say he's held good on that promise. Mm-hmm. And they've done a big batch of the RFK files, and this caused quite a stir. They did release photos from RFK's autopsy, which are very hard to look at, but I think they're important because they show those wounds that the coroner, Thomas Noguchi, talked about, that were contact wounds, basically being pressed up close to Senator Kennedy's body, or 1 to 3 inches away, which showed that Sirhan could not have caused those. That's a whole other can of worms, but that's why I do think the records release is a net positive overall. But yeah, there is some stuff where it's kind of like, all right, yeah, this isn't we've either seen this before, or this doesn't really relate to the assassination. But to your point about stuff being cleaner, there are now copies of stuff that had previously been redacted that are not redacted, so we can fill in what that said, what that information was that we didn't know. Like, it could have been a document that was released in the 90s and it had a whole paragraph that was blacked out. That paragraph is now no longer blacked out, and we can compare those documents. So That's a great thing, I think. And the researchers are pouring through all those documents as we speak. And, you know, basically they've shown that, yes, the CIA was following Lee Harvey Oswald from 1959 all the way up to a week or two before the assassination. And they've never given a really explanation for that. So that's 4 years that they were looking at. And they're opening his mail. They're opening his mother's mail. And they said, oh, we don't really know much about him at the time. The Warren Commission came out in 64. What do you know about Lee Harvey Oswald? He went to the Soviet Union. He said he was going to defect. Oh, we don't really know much about him. But it turns out they knew a lot about him. And I actually think he was recruited into a false defector program in the late 50s to pose as sympathetic to the Soviet Union and tell them he was going to give them information about the U-2 program and about American secrets. And the Russians knew he didn't have anything, and they ultimately knew he was full of baloney, and he became disenchanted with being over there, and he's able to come back to America no problem with a loan from the State Department. Mm-hmm. So at the height of the Cold War, you don't just go over to the Soviet Union, say that you're gonna defect, and then come back to America a couple years later without like any problems. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there's something more going on there.
Yeah. So I would suggest people looking to James Angleton, the stuff they've released about him, because counterintelligence was a big part of his job. And I think what they did with Oswald is they just threw him out there to say, as like a, this is a little appetizer for you. And, and they didn't bite. And gotcha. then they repurposed him and set him up for Dallas as some crazy pro-Cuban sympathizing communist. And there you go. You know, he is what he said, a patsy.
Yeah. Wow. Well, you know what, Mike, I like I said, I know you're a little short on time. We'll definitely have to do a follow-up show, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe me, you, and Eric, and then I'll have to reach out to Corey Hughes. You'll have to set me up with him, and I would love to kind of pick his brain a little bit when I verse myself a little bit more. But I'm learning more and more. I kind of have to listen to a lot of this stuff over and over again.
Absolutely.
To kind of get a good grip on it. So why don't you let everybody know where they can support you, find you, and all that good stuff?
Yes, you can support Jackman Radio on our YouTube channel. Where we also have a Patreon, patreon.com/JackmanRadio if you want to sign up. I'm on Venmo, Mike Jackman 1986, if you like the work I do and you want to send us a tip. And you can listen to us on Podbean as well as Spotify and iTunes.
Beautiful. All right. Well, Mike, this was awesome, man. I really appreciate you taking the time, Dave. If you've got anything else, we'll close her out there.
No, I appreciate it. And thanks for having me on. I've talked horror flicks and the Kennedy assassination anytime, man.
And, yeah, for sure.
We'll have to have you back on sometime soon too, Kyle.
Yeah, dude, absolutely love to do it. So everybody, thank you so much. There will be a Sunday coffee. So until then, everybody, have a good night and take care.
Thank you.
Saving money right now at Menards. From smoke and carbon monoxide detectors to fire extinguishers and more, Kidde Home Safety products keep your family protected in case of emergencies. Smoke and carbon monoxide detectors are perfect for your living spaces, offering protection and peace of mind. Save big money on all Kidde products at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only.
Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.